Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When the Supreme Court took the lid off money in American politics last year, the Koch brothers were already loaded for bear. Combined wealth bumping up against Bill Gates and Warren Buffett's, a huge private empire of oil and chemical business, a political philosophy determined to take down government and regulation. They are not alone in big money politics, but their story is arresting for its fierce impact. This hour on Point, Money Politics, America's Future, and the Koch brothers. You can join the conversation. Can you picture two brothers, their private company, with more skin in the game than ExxonMobil, than Chevron? Could their billions steer the whole ship? Critical policy. Or, after George Soros and union money and Hollywood, is it all a wash? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPointRadio. And usually, there's a little sound of the Koch brothers' world in cyberspace these days. A couple of weeks ago, carefully guarded meeting of wealthy conservative activists, an annual event organized by the Koch brothers, convened at a resort in Rancho Mirage, California, near Palm Springs. Now, word of that meeting's location leaked out, unusually, and various liberal groups and good government activists held a protest outside the resort. Liberal groups really putting a magnifying glass on these two brothers and their money, their corporate money, private corporation. Here's environmental activist Joel Francis, one of the speakers at the protest rally across the road. There were arrests before it was all over, but this is across the road from the Koch brothers' annual meeting.
Now, Charles Koch and his friends are spending hundreds of millions of dollars to influence our democratic elections. Our democracy, our health, our prosperity should not be in the hands of these polluters, bankers, and secret billionaires meeting behind those closed doors right across the street.
There's the protesters' view. Let's hear from the Kochs themselves, or at least one. Liberal blogger Li Fang posted some video of a street interview here that he managed to get last month, unusually, with David Koch. Fang, who kind of ambushed Koch, works for the Center for American Progress. That's a progressive think tank with strong ties to the Obama administration. You'll hear Fang first.
What you're expecting from the new Congress,
Well, cut the hell out of spending and balance the budget and reduce regulations and support business.
And the little ambush street interview went on.
Mr. Koch, are you proud of the Tea Party movement and what they've achieved in the past
year? Yeah, there's some extremists there, but the rank and file are just normal people like us. And I admire them. It's probably the best grassroots uprising since 1776.
Just normal people like us. Well, maybe, but there are many, many, many billions at play here. Joining me now are Kathleen Hennessy and Tom Hamburger, Washington Bureau reporters for the Los Angeles Times. Kathleen covers Congress. Tom covers money and politics. They teamed up for a big piece over the weekend that's drawn a lot of attention. It was headlined, Koch Brothers Now at Heart of GOP Power. Kathleen Hennessy, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom. It's good to be here.
And Tom Hamburger, thank you for joining us.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Okay, fill in the blanks a little bit. That's a big headline. Begin to justify that for us, Kathleen. How do you put that, at heart of GOP power? Make the case.
Well, I think what we were pointing to was that the Koch brothers have sort of lived somewhat on the outskirts, some might say the fringes, of Republican power for a long time. They've spent a lot of money here and there, but haven't ever done what they've started to do in the past few years, which is sort of mobilize large numbers of people, play in a serious way in elections across the country, and contribute more sort of specifically to candidates and grassroots organizations. And that's put them with, there were a lot of factors in the last election that sort of put the wind at their back in that, but it placed them in a real position of power in this Congress.
Tom, the Supreme Court decision, Citizens United, obviously opened the way for a whole lot of money, and it's not just conservative money. But here, the Koch brothers came barreling in. They have, as Kathleen says, been around for a long time, sort of planting the seeds of this, seed money for the Libertarian Cato Institute, for the Federalist Society. Think tanks were their business for a long time. But now you and Kathleen are writing, Tom, that they've got much more direct ties right into some very critical committees in Congress.
Yes, Tom, one of the things that we noticed, as Kathleen just said, is that they have moved more aggressively from the funding of think tanks and sort of promoting ideas in Washington to promoting candidates and the election of like-minded politicians. They've long been interested in this and in influencing government and the established order, I suppose. But one of the things, if you follow the Koch brothers through the years, is that they've been on the outskirts in the sense that David Koch in 1980 ran as a libertarian candidate for vice president. Ronald Reagan, that was the same year that Ronald Reagan was running.
Ran to the right of Ronald Reagan.
They've, in the past, been dissenting members of some of the city's most powerful institutions on occasion. I'm thinking now of the American Petroleum Institute or the Chamber of Commerce, in part because they were unbending libertarian conservatives. They were very principled, as described by all of those who've worked with them, but it made them sit off to the sidelines a bit. They would be worried about
the state of the Republican Chamber of Commerce and the Petroleum Institute were not conservative mm-hmm. enough for them.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And even Ronald Reagan wasn't sufficiently mm-hmm. conservative. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in the early part of in the last few years, they had complained when George W. Bush was president and the Republicans controlled the Congress that Republican era was the Republican leaders at that time weren't sufficiently conservative.
Of course, a lot of
now,
Republicans
we're describing
have now
is
said
a change.
That.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
A lot of Republicans have now said that George W. Bush's era wasn't conservative enough. But I don't know. Maybe the Koch brothers' megaphone is part of what's driving that interpretation.
Well, that's part of our theory and part of what led us to conclude that they are now really at the heart of Republican power in a way they have never been before in their many decades of pushing the party towards the right and towards their libertarian free market ethos.
Describe how they sit there at the heart, then, of Republican power as you see it, Tom.
One of the things that we've noticed this year is a campaign which a wave election in which several of the themes that were sounded on government regulation broadly and on environmental policy, global warming, the role of the EPA specifically, those themes resonated through key congressional races around the country. One of the things that that we notice is, one, that the language, the terms of the debate were similar and sometimes precisely mirrored those that the Koch brothers and their allies have argued for, as we said, sort of on the outside in the past. It's become mainstream thinking in the Republican Party, among the Republican leadership, all the way to Speaker Boehner, to the rhetoric used by the new chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee, who has declared as one of his goals relieving the EPA chokehold, as he calls it, on the American economy.
Kathleen, can you buy mainstream thinking? Is that what you're asserting here?
Well, I think, you know, we're sort of careful to monitor lots of different things happening at the same time. Certainly, what I think we can say is that we can see the Koch brothers and some of the organizations that they funded sort of planting the seeds early for a certain conversation to take place later. They you know, particularly on the EPA, I mean, they have sort of taken an anti-regulatory stance for years and pushed a certain line of rhetoric while even in the past year, while lots of other groups were focusing on healthcare and government spending, they continued to sort of push a lower key message of anti-EPA, sort of anti-regulatory approach on the environment. And it sort of lived in kind of a low, maybe sort of a low-grade space in many races. But in some key places, it really drove the race and drove the conversation. I think this was a moment where they found a lot of people interested in that way of thinking. I think they feel like they, in the Tea Party movement, found a lot of sort of surprising amount of allies at this moment, and they they tried to take advantage of that and were somewhat successful.
A movement which they helped to build, as you and others lay out. It's hard to see their interest in energy. We'll look at the House Energy Committee and the influence or the connections they now have there, as you describe it. But here, the Koch brothers with Koch Industries have the second largest privately run company in the country. It's in oil refining and pipeline and chemicals, and the paper business have got Brawny paper towels and Dixie cups and Georgia Pacific lumber and Stainmaster carpet and Lycra. I mean, this is a huge, huge company. Describe the scale of their presence now in the American political money flow, Tom.
The Koch brothers have used their vast wealth, really, through their adult lifetime. To promote conservative libertarian thought. We talked about the institutes that they've supported in the past. As the company has grown, their donations, their philanthropy, and their political contributions have grown as well. One of the things that we tracked was a fairly dramatic rise over the past decade in the amount of money contributed to political candidates, which suggested to us a shift in interest from just supporting think tanks and sort of academic-style research and even philosophy to making it more action-oriented, actually changing the nature of government. And we could do they are not alone in this, but on the conservative side of the political spectrum, they are among the most important donors, significant donors to Republican causes and to conservative causes.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Koch brothers and big money influence in America's political system with Kathleen Hennessy and Tom Hamburger of the Los Angeles Times. Their big piece over the weekend was Koch brothers now at heart of GOP power. Now, you can find big write-ups of the money in the last campaign season. Here I'm looking in the Wall Street Journal. They've got the Center for Responsive Politics chart here. Top AFSCME, big labor union, heavily Democratic, $87 million. U.S. Chamber of Commerce, $75 million. American Crossroads and Crossroads GOP, that's Karl Rove's conservative group, $65 million. And then Service Employees International, $44 million. National Education Association, $40 million. And right in there, in the play of American politics, the Koch brothers with their many interests through all kinds of operations. Tom and Kathleen have tracked that. Tom, take us to the House Energy and Commerce Committee, which is right at the heart of American energy policy and a whole lot more, and the sort of traces that you find all through here of Koch brothers' money influence.
Tom, if I can talk just for a moment about the overall contributions and the place of the Koch brothers in funding some of the organizations that you've mentioned.
Great.
You'd used the figure earlier, $40 million, and indeed that is the amount of money that a Koch-founded organization, Americans for Prosperity, claimed to announced that they plan to spend in this last election. Mm-hmm. It's a considerable amount, as you just described, but it is not as much as the two labor unions that you mentioned. And one of the things that we don't know, in part because of the increasingly opaque nature of campaign-related organization funding now, we don't know exactly how much the Koch brothers may have contributed to Americans for Prosperity. Mm-hmm. We know that they have great financial capability, and we know that David Koch is, as we heard in the clip that you played earlier, is closely associated with Americans for Prosperity. But the amount of money comes under this sort of blanket of uncertainty that we reporters who try to track this stuff find when we go to examine some of the new organizations, particularly those thriving since the Citizens United case that you mentioned earlier.
We take your point. Some of it is from them personally. Some is from their company. Some is from big organizations that they've helped found. I mean, certainly their resources are great. Forbes has them, each worth $21.5 billion, fifth richest people in the country. But take us in. I mean, you've gone sort of line by line here on this committee where they have a company that's in oil and chemicals and right in the ballpark of the House Energy and Commerce Committee.
So yes, and so now we're Yes, and so the $40 million total, as you just said, we don't know how much actually came from the Kochs and how much may have come from their related entities and how much is from other citizens. But on the Energy and Commerce Committee, we're able to track through the Federal Election Commission how much individual members get. These are amounts of money that are disclosed in hard money traditional campaign contributions. And there we found in the last couple of campaign cycles, say since 2006, the Wichita-based Koch Industries and its employees, it's important to note, emerged as the largest single oil and gas company donor to members of the Energy and Commerce Committee.
Bigger than ExxonMobil, bigger than Chevron, bigger than all the big names in oil.
Yes, all of the sort of household names, and actually in some cases much larger companies, have been surpassed by the Koch brothers in their contributions to the Energy and Commerce Committee. Over time, in the last election cycle, they contributed $279,000 to 22 of the committee's 31 Republicans. Important to note that five Democrats on that committee received $32,000, but overwhelmingly the contributions went to Republicans and to 22 members of that committee. Nine of the new 12 Republicans on the panel had signed a pledge that was distributed by Americans for Prosperity, the Koch-founded advocacy group, that opposed using any tax dollars to regulate greenhouse gases. In effect, that would effectively mean they're stating their opposition to cap and trade or the most the legislation that was passed in the last Congress to try to deal with greenhouse gases. And of the six GOP freshmen on the panel, five had received critical or substantial assistance from Americans for Prosperity. In other words, it was possible to argue that their elections were due in part to some of the extraordinary efforts made by this organization, which is backed in part by David Koch.
So when it comes to policy and Congressman Kathleen Hennessey, what kind of attention does that kind of money buy?
Well, I think we saw almost immediately some of what it bought. I don't want to say bought, but some of the results. One congressman in particular who was elected in a district where AFP, was, Americans for Prosperity, was very active, is a guy named Congressman Morgan Griffith. He's from southwestern Virginia. He all of Americans for Prosperity's activities are separate from the campaign. This is a what's called generally an independent expenditure. They don't coordinate with the campaigns, but these folks know of their activities and they're aware of them. And Congressman Griffith showed up at a rally 2 weeks after his election to say thank you to Americans for Prosperity and to talk about how he was going to rein in the EPA. And I think He's one example, and there are lots of others on the committee where that language is repeated over and over again. And perhaps, it's one thing for freshmen coming in who seem to have had that position all along. There are others on the committee that seem to be sort of shifting to a harder line on the EPA and on, certainly cap and trade legislation, which seems to be dead, at least in this Congress.
Tom, one of those who appears to have shifted is the committee's chairman, Fred Upton of Michigan. What about the relationship there?
Well, Fred Upton had in the past been criticized by conservatives. I don't know if he was specifically criticized by the Kochs, but he was known as something of a moderate on environmental issues. He was concerned, had expressed concern about global warming. He supported the Clean Air Act. And now he is leading the way this cycle after winning election as the new chairman of this committee in the fight, if you will, against the EPA. He announced last week that he's going to be introducing legislation that would effectively block EPA authority to regulate greenhouse gases. And he has on the committee and in his the agenda material, which he's issued since he became chairman, indicated that he's looking to really go after the EPA. He's told the EPA administrator that she should prepare to spend a great deal of time before his committee. From environmental organizations and from Democrats say the change in this committee is maybe one of the most astonishing, if not the most remarkable, in the whole of the post-election transformation of the Congress. Of course, Republicans took the House, but the change in committee chairman from the past chairman, Henry Waxman, the California congressman, who really led the way to pass in the House legislation to rein in global warming, to Fred Upton, a chairman who is now attacking both the Clean Air Act or its recent interpretation and the EPA, is a huge change and one of the most dramatic that we've seen in the since the last election.
You quote Jeremy Simmons at the National Wildlife Federation talking about a change on the committee and its outlook like night and day. He says, in the past, the committee majority viewed the Clean Air Act as an effective way to protect the public. Now the committee treats the Clean Air Act and the EPA as if they are the enemy. Let's go to our callers. Corbin, Kentucky. John is on the line. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you see?
Well, I think your guests are looking for a boogeyman under every bush. I mean, there's just a lot of people like the people they're talking about, the Koch brothers, out there in business. I think business has been chaffed by the EPA ever since it was formed under the Nixon administration, and the fact that Carl Rove's out there, yeah, I think he's plowing fertile ground. And I'm for regulation, but I think there's big business is just opposed to it.
So let us pick it up. I mean, Kathleen, how about it? We heard it just yesterday at the Chamber of Commerce speech that the president gave, and the reaction there from people in the Chamber of Commerce, concern about environmental regulation, exhaust regulation. You know, John says, what's the big deal about the Koch brothers? There's lots of business resistance to this.
And I think in a lot of ways he's absolutely right. I think there are a lot of people who think like the Koch brothers. There aren't a lot of people with the money to spend, advocating that point of view in the way that the Koch brothers have. I don't know that there's anyone else on the conservative side who's organized in spending in this way. I also think that something different has happened in the last couple of years, where what the Koch brothers are doing is not just sort of spending money and on individual candidates or think tanks anymore. I mean, in Americans for Prosperity, they've found basically sort of a political arm. And in the Tea Party and in some of the protests that have happened over the past year, they've found sort of a whole new cast of activists that are working at the state level, even on state legislation, in 30 plus states and probably in almost every state, and that's a sort of a grassroots network that they've never had before, and I think that is part of why they are so influential. When Tim Phillips, who is the president of Americans for Prosperity, wanted to talk to Fred Upton about Chairman Upton about what his position was going to be on the EPA, all he described to me the conversation, which was basically about the massive grassroots campaign that they were going to lead on this issue. They were going to have rallies in every district. They were going to have bus tours. They were going to be doing phone calls and advertising. They are a sort of a local and national player all at once. And I don't think – I think that sets them apart in some way than any other sort of just corporate interest that's spending money here.
So not just up in the clouds throwing down money, but right maybe in your backyard, right at your constituent meeting. Paul in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Pretty well. What do you see, Paul?
Well, what I see is not a great change in American history. I mean, at least since the time of Gould and Commodore Vanderbilt, mm-hmm. Tom Scott buying legislatures for the railroads and of course, H.L. Hunt and that crew with the oil industry. I mean, it's always been the best government money can buy. And the thing that I find distressing is not so much these guys spending money to buy candidates, which is, in effect, exactly what they're doing, as the people and a grassroots movement that's actually supporting them. I mean, I guess my question really is, where's William Jennings Bryan and Huey Long when you need them?
So you say, Paul. We'll look at it. Thanks for your call. Tom, first, you know, same old here is Paul's observation. I wonder what's your response to that. Are we in an era where there's something different going on? He's talking about Gould and Vanderbilt and, you know, big names in certainly buying influence in American history. And what about the counterweight here? Is it George Soros? He's looking for William Jennings Bryan.
Well, we should talk about it. Maybe it's even worth comparing, Tom, the George Soros with the Koch brothers, because both are cited as your first caller suggested, as sort of the bogeyman, those who are in control. This George Soros leading the left and funding it, the Koch brothers leading the right and funding the libertarian okay. conservative alliance. I was struck by your first caller's comment that there are plenty of business people who share the Koch brothers' views of regulation. That's absolutely right. A new study that was just released yesterday by the new chairman of the Oversight and Investigations Committee, Daryl Issa, found this was a survey of leading corporations and found overwhelming concern with burdensome regulation and, in particular, concern number one directed at the EPA. What we're saying our theory is here is that the Koch brothers are not dictating the terms of the debate or controlling the Congress or the debate single-handedly. Okay. Mm-hmm. But what they've effectively done through the money that they've sent to think tanks, through this new grassroots-oriented Americans for Prosperity organization, is marshal resources so that when you have an election year like we had in 2010 – their views, once considered somewhat on the outside, become mainstream and are endorsed. They help set the terms of the debate and then marshal support for their point of view. This sort of thing has happened before, as your second caller said. There are those who see Washington, particularly in this era when we've got huge financial players like the Koch brothers on the one hand and George Soros on the other, as a sort of new gilded age in which those with money are controlling the terms of, are controlling the Congress. We think it's a little it's more complicated than that, and in important ways, because it's not just controlling the Congress; it's campaigning and trying to influence people on the grassroots level, and at one person's manipulation of voters can be another person's sort of grassroots democratic activity, just the kind that's protected in the Constitution and that's at the heart of democracy.
So in some ways, you're not disagreeing with our caller who says this is all through American history. I guess what's surprising is that it's come back after a time where maybe it wasn't as prominent, and it's come back with more sophistication. If it's sort of buying not just decision makers, but perhaps as you're describing it, I'm sort of hearing you describing buying public opinion up and down the political system. Or is it just in line with public opinion up and down the political system? If grassroots support it, Tom, and other businessmen support it, maybe the Koch brothers are just lining up with American opinion, not buying it.
Tom, that is a fair and even a potent argument. What's different and what concerns some of the reformers about the current environment is that it is possible for wealthy individuals to participate in both through advertising, through grassroots efforts, and to influence the course of the grassroots debates in ways we have not seen before. And that's one of the questions that's at play. Is this just a sort of innocuous demonstration of democracy and how it works in the 21st century? Or is it something that's allowing economic interests to, in a sense, dominate the debate? That's why we dive into the topic. We're trying to find out.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Koch brothers, K-O-C-H, and big money influence in America's political system with Kathleen Hennessy and Tom Hamburger, reporters for the Los Angeles Times. Their big piece out last weekend was Koch brothers now at heart of GOP power. Islam in Marlboro, Massachusetts. Islam, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I just want to say I'm a libertarian. I consider myself a libertarian. I have been a libertarian for so many years, even before I heard of the Koch brothers. To me, they are irrelevant. I am socially extremely liberal, and economically, I guess I would, in this country, I would be called a conservative, but in the rest of the world, I would be called but extremely liberal as well.
Okay.
I'm anti-war. I did campaign for Ron Paul, and when he didn't get the nomination as expected, I did campaign for President Obama.
But how can you say the Koch brothers are irrelevant, you know, if they're swinging that much money?
Well, they are irrelevant in the sense that people follow or believe in libertarian principles, as you would like to call them. I would like to call it classical liberalism. It's whether they're there or not, they're not going to change my belief that the principles of libertarianism are what is good for this country. Very simple, live and let live. Anti-war. These are all principles, and I am no Tea Party member, for God's sake. I'm no Republican. I campaigned against George Bush first to when he got elected both times. He could have his own ulterior motives. I'm sure he does, like everyone else in the system.
Yeah, he's got the second biggest privately owned company in the country. Those are pretty big interests, but we take your point, Islam. Kathleen, Tom, what about it? Here's a libertarian. He says, what's the problem here? Live and let live. You know, hey, the Koch brothers can feel that way. Big deal.
I think, you know, one of the questions that gets raised in that, I mean, people often compare the Kochs and George Soros and looking at the way they spend their money and the kinds of issues that they target. And, you know, the question often becomes, well, are the Koch brothers just advancing their own business interests or are they following an ideological approach to government? And certainly they would argue that the way that they spend their money and the candidates they support are not to advance their own individual economic interests, but are in line with this larger ideological worldview that the caller just described. And then, you know, critics would point to Soros and say, well, he places money on things and puts money on things that don't necessarily affect his corporate interests, and therefore somehow that's a better use or a more legitimate use of spending in campaigns and government. And I don't think there's a really clear answer to that.
Tom, I mean, let's look first at the ideological part of that. Islam says he's a live and let live libertarian. Does that describe the Kochs? I mean, they want to, as I understand it, I mean, it's the absolute minimum government, absolute minimum regulation, not big on Social Security. Is their vision of the United States anything like what we've known in the last 40, 50 years?
One of the things that we know, Tom, and that we hear from everyone who knows the Koch brothers and who has interacted with them, and by the way, I did want to tell you, we tried multiple times to talk with them and seek comment from them for our story. They're famously shy of the press and doing interviews, but we did talk to many of their friends and associates who described them to us as ideologically committed to libertarian / conservative principles, to the point that their friends and associates at least are convinced that their actions all are played out in a desire to promote the libertarian philosophy, the free market ethos, and the notion of small government, lower taxes. And as your caller said, I suppose, live and let live. They are not adopting or part of the social conservative movement, though they were, and perhaps this explains their success this year, close to and coordinating, if not working with, the Tea Party movement, which had a huge impact on this year's elections. If I were your caller, when Islam just called a moment ago and suggested live and let live, well, one of the things that all of us who are Democrats, whether our views are liberal or libertarian, is to sort of know, is to understand how our democracy is working and to check on it every once in a while.
When
and
you
see.
Say Democrat, do you mean Democratic Party members or just folks in a democracy?
I meant folks in a democracy.
Okay.
Thanks for clearing that up. So one of the questions I was thinking back to one of the things that inspired our story is the change that took place in rhetoric and in the in many of the key congressional debates and elections of this last time. Thinking of in Delaware, former Representative Mike Castle looked at one point as though he might be a shoe-in for election to the U.S. Senate. And he was defeated by this, what David Koch referred to in the clip you played earlier as a kind of grassroots rebellion. He lost to a Tea Party candidate. When we interviewed him for this story, though, he said the dominant issue, the thing that was just overwhelming and so striking to him, was the attack that he came under for voting for the so-called cap-and-trade legislation to limit global warming and limit greenhouse gases.
Mm-hmm.
And he said the environment has changed so dramatically, really, in one election that he said if you're a Republican and you even utter the phrase climate change, you'd better duck. To Islam's question, one of the things that we wonder about is how did that quick change occur? And as reporters, we thought it's worth sort of looking under the hood to see whether there were groups or individuals who were promoting both specific candidates, but also a change in the way we talk about and think about government regulation, including some of those that had been widely accepted. I'm thinking now of the Clean Air Act.
And it's changed in a hurry. I mean, there's the ideological side. Jane Mayer wrote, of course, in the New Yorker last summer about the Koch brothers, describing their politics as a libertarian, believing in drastically lower personal and corporate taxes, minimal social services for the needy, much less oversight of industry. You can call those ideological, but when you own the second biggest private company in the country, I mean, these get mixed up in a hurry. Cap and trade and the EPA oversight would cost their company, Tom, a lot of money.
Exactly right, which is part of the reason we chose to focus on this Energy and Commerce Committee, the core business of Koch Industries, which, as you described earlier, is massive and diversified. But the core industry is refineries, oil and chemical refining, and those industries are regulated by the Environmental Protection Agency. And in the Koch brothers' lobbying, for their company, as well as in their political campaigns, they have generally attacked the EPA and regulation, which is very costly to their company.
And did you have the numbers on Koch brothers versus George Soros in terms of what the sort of Koch arena throws in and George Soros throws in to American politics? Are there actual numbers?
We do have some of those numbers, and I'm glad that you asked because I think it is worth comparing when we talk about the influence that wealthy individuals can have on our politics. It is not in any way unique to the Republican Party or to the Koch brothers. As you compare the two, we get into it can be a little difficult to compare because they play on different levels in this game. For example, we just talked about lobbying. The Koch brothers have spent millions on lobbying, that is, going to members of Congress and the administration and urging often a weakening of regulation which would support the company's interest. George Soros, who is basically owner of a hedge fund with diversified investments, does not spend any money in lobbying. The Koch brothers have spent close to $6 million over the last couple of decades on campaign contributions. George Soros has spent far less. But when you look at least what we can tell about the funding of these new organizations, the 527s as they're called, the 501c4 organizations, which have expanded dramatically since the Citizens United case, there, at least from what we can tell, George Soros is a far bigger player than the Koch brothers, spending over the last 10 years or so about $35.1 billion compared to million. Mm-hmm. Compared to a couple of million on the part of the Koch brothers. Now, part of what we hear from the Soros folks is George Soros discloses his contributions. The Koch brothers don't have the same level of transparency.
And if you look back at the lobbying, you've got something like $57.5 million from Koch brothers in that category. I'm seeing some reports here.
Yes, over time. And you have and as we said, almost nothing spent by the by Soros on lobbying. So you have a very powerful, I'd argue that both have an enormous influence, but the influence is expressed in different ways. If I can mention, though, one of the things that goes on between both of these groups, if you talk to conservative libertarian activists on the one hand, you will hear about George Soros. They particularly point to the Soros investment of about $24 million in just a couple of years into the 2004 effort to defeat George Bush and return Democrats to power. That had a huge effect on conservatives and on the right, and we believe also on the Koch brothers, who then sought to match that sort of influence and investment.
Conservatives point at Soros, Common Cause, and others now pointing at the Koch brothers. Everybody's got their boogeyman, but the interest is... The interests are very, very large here. We've got a lot of feedback online on Facebook. Judy says, the Koch brothers exemplify the rising American plutocracy. Dan says, as best I can tell, the Koch brothers have yet to do anything illegal, simply capitalizing on the foolishness, he writes, of the American people. It's caveat emptor for the political arena. And then, of course, there are unions and Karl Rove and lots of others out there. I'm not sure it's all the same, though. Lisa in Nashville, you're on the air, Lisa. Thanks for calling.
Hi there, Tom. You know, I'm just hearing a lot of false equivalencies flying around in the conversation. I really do think it's disingenuous to equate union donations with corporate money like the Koch brothers, because
okay.
Unions are made up of thousands of their members. It's their money, the workers' money, which is going towards lobbying and campaign ads.
Right.
The Koch brothers are basically two wealthy and powerful individuals and maybe a handful of their highly paid top executives. And they are using their position and personal wealth to buy our elections. So I do think it's like apples and oranges.
Lisa, I'm glad you called. Tom, quickly, what do you say? Apples and oranges if we compare unions and the Koch brother investments in politics?
There is some apples and oranges, and your caller makes a good point, I think, that there is certainly a difference between a mass membership organization making donations and a couple of individuals doing that. One of the things that we know and we saw in the last election, and something that's happened since the changes in the Supreme Court decision, is that union executives with control over their treasuries can make decisions now to invest in specific campaigns, often at the last minute, and change the nature and the dynamics of specific races. Corporations have the opportunity to do that as well. And if you are an individual who owns a privately owned corporation, as the Koch brothers do, or if you're extraordinarily wealthy, as George Soros is, that's where I think the equivalency is more appropriate, because these individuals can invest in politics and political activities in ways that influence our political system and in some ways our thinking that are outsized. And it's that where I would point to. I'm not saying that it's equivalent, but it's where we want to pay attention. Both parties now, and both the left and the right, are paying attention, in part because of what we saw just in this last election, to getting wealthy individuals, imagine sort of junior versions of the Koch brothers and George Soros, to contribute to new organizations that will play on the grassroots, that will run advertising, and maybe influence the debate in the way we saw it. In this past election.
Money politics all over. Lisa says, watch out for false equivalencies. Rob in Savannah, Georgia. Thanks for calling, Rob. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Just wanted to say that it seems pretty clear to me that their influence in politics with their money is specifically directed at the bottom line of their businesses. I mean, if you just take, for example, their ownership of GP,
Georgia Pacific, yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Wood Products and Paper Company. You know, the way that the cap trade legislation was structured would have essentially dramatically hurt their bottom line. So it doesn't really seem like there's any uncertainty, at least in my mind, that, you know, their ability to influence campaigns and who sits on what committees, you know, just directly, you know, benefit their bottom line.
Rob, I appreciate your call. Certainly, Kathleen and Tom are pointing to some weight behind the House Energy and Commerce Committee here. Peggy in Mount Vernon, Kentucky. Peggy, you're on the air.
Hello. I just have been listening to everybody since I called in. I've been listening on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And there is so much that I think I'm left only with one question, and that is, will the Obama administration and Congress be able to withstand this last assault on regulations, specifically on the EPA? I don't understand how this is. It's not understood that this affects us all, whether we're multimillionaires or as poor as I am. I just don't understand it.
The very air we breathe. Our time is short, Peggy. Kathleen, what about it? Supreme Court ruled in 07 that the EPA had the power to regulate greenhouse gases as air pollutants under the Clean Air Act. Now there's this move to strip the EPA of that authority, and it's pretty strong. What about Peggy's question? Is that going down? Is that effort going down with all of those consequences?
Well, and we focus primarily on the House, where Republicans are in control, and I think that you will likely see some legislation come through the House that does some version of stripping the EPA of that authority. But as you know, we're living in an era of divided government, and it's not entirely clear, but I would guess that wouldn't make it very far in the Senate, and I don't think it's something that the Obama administration has endorsed.
So you think the EPA will sustain its authority despite the efforts to strip it?
I think there will be there might be some tinkering, but I shouldn't try to make predictions mm-hmm. here. But my guess is that's not something that's going very far.
If it should happen, Tom, would that be a Koch brothers victory?
It would be an enormous victory for the Koch brothers, and both in the Koch brothers and their allies in other businesses regulated by the EPA are working hard both in the House and Senate. And if nothing else, they may try. Their fallback position will be a 2-year moratorium on EPA regulation of greenhouse gases.
One story of big money in American politics. There are many. Tom Hamburger and Kathleen Hennessy with the LA Times. Their piece this weekend was Koch brothers now at heart of GOP power. Tom, Kathleen, thank you to you both for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.